Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Law is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiL, This Week in Law with Denise Howell, Mike Keyes, Emery Roan, and Matt Curtis. Episode 410, recorded December 29th, 2017. Best of 2017. Hey there, hi there, and ho, ho, ho there. It's Denise Howell, host of This Week in Law, along with my fabulous co-hosts, Emery Roan, Mike Keyes, and Matt Curtis, who have alternately co-hosted the show with me throughout 2017. And we're here bringing you our best of 2017 episode of This Week in Law. Thank you for joining us along the way. Thank you for contributing your suggested clips that we include here. We hope you enjoy. This is the terrible, terrible story of journalist Kurt Eichenwald being targeted by someone who sent him, I think it was a direct message, or maybe it was just a public tweet, a link to a GIF that was a strobe that was calculated to trigger an epileptic seizure. And he had one instance where that was a close call and it didn't happen. And then one instance where his wife actually grabbed his device and tweeted back to the person, "Well, you succeeded. My husband's having a seizure." So they have pursued this. And interestingly enough, a man has been arrested now last Friday, I believe, at his Maryland residence. His name is John Rain Rivello, and he has been identified as the person who allegedly sent this strobing image to journalist Kurt Eichenwald. So he is going to face charges for assault via that tweet. There's an interesting story about how his identity was revealed. I think that we, at the time that we talked about it with Keith, they didn't know who this person was, and that Kurt Eichenwald and the police were actively pursuing an investigation, trying to figure out who he was. And there's a great story at Ars Technica by David Kravitz there, describing, you know, the way in which this was all kind of unwound and the way in which the phone number associated with an Apple iCloud account had been used to open the Twitter account that sent the tweet, and thus cascading series of events, they were able to find this person. And now he will face charges. Mike Keyes, what do you think?
Yeah, we had a very interesting discussion, as people remember, with Keith Lee a number of weeks ago when we're talking about the unique nature of a case like this. Personally, I'm really, really delighted to see that this has been investigated and that it looks like the authorities are really taking this very seriously. I think he's been charged or arrested for criminal cyber stalking with intent to kill. At least I think that's what somebody reported. And very interesting story about how this was all unearthed. You know, kudos to his wife, who she saw on the screen the tweet from this particular individual and actually did a screen capture of it, which I think was really helpful to the authorities in investigating this guy. So the other interesting things that were uncovered apparently during this investigation is the fellow that sent this terrible tweet to this reporter had actually sent direct messages to other people saying, you know, this will cause a seizure or something to that effect, showing an intent that he really did intend for this poor guy to experience a seizure. So terrible, terrible, terrible story, but really glad that this is being taken with such seriousness.
Right. And groundbreaking in that, you know, as we discussed when we first brought this up, generally assaults require some kind of physical touching. And this did not, but clearly was an assault. Professor Madison, anything you want to add?
Just two quick notes. This isn't my primary area, so I'll just comment quickly on from a public policy standpoint. I agree with Mike that in the instance here, clearly it sounds like malicious behavior and sort of the right steps are being taken in the short term. In a broader sense, it seems that this sort of thing, I hate to say it, is going to become more common, meaning that harm inflicted using virtual technology. And current criminal justice frameworks, current legal systems, both at the state and federal levels, aren't really set up to analyze these directly. It's more of a square peg, round hole problem. And in this particular instance, they seem to have gotten all the resources lined up in a productive way. But that's not a guaranteed outcome going forward. The other quick thought that I had listening to your description was I was reminded of one of the most famous New Yorker cartoons ever from about 25 years ago. And it's the New Yorker cartoon that featured a picture of a dog sitting at a keyboard. And the caption, which is what lives on, is, "On the internet, no one knows you're a dog." And that's simply not true anymore. The technology and sophistication of the internet and all of its different aspects has evolved to the point where the kind of investigation that took place in this instance is possible. And that's a significant change in how we all experience the internet in our daily lives in terms of ordinary consumer life, social interaction, business use, global activity, and so forth. That's a lot of change in a relatively short period of time.
Drone law continues to be a favorite topic for us to follow here at This Week in Law, and 2017 was no exception. Here's a clip about DJI adding first-person view VR goggles to some of their drones, but not, coincidentally enough, taking on the FAA's conflicting rules. The more consumer-friendly beyond drone racing use of first-person view goggles to fly drones caught my eye this week that DJI, who makes the really popular, really fun-to-use drone, the Phantom, has some goggles now that will control it. The goggles seem to be designed to make the drone piloting experience, first of all, much more wow factor, because it really gives you this first-person virtual reality kind of experience. They also seem to be trying to make it broaden their audience away from the tech drone photography geek just to someone who might want to have an interesting experience.
These drone companies, yeah. DJI in particular, they made this drone called the Phantom, and they implemented a lot of fail safes in them so that to make it accessible to just about anybody. What they did was they added a GPS chip to it so that the thing knew where it was. If you flew out of transmission range for your controller, it would fly back. If it started running out of batteries, it would automatically fly back. So they made these things really dummy-proof. And so the next step with this the VR headset is to make you feel like you're a miniature pilot sitting on your drone, and that is just so cool. I had the privilege to go to CES, not this year, but last year, and drones were all over the place. And things like drones with these headsets were all over the place. And how cool is that? It's like playing a real-life video game. Except you can then take pictures of your neighbors eating dinner. So there's that whole other aspect of it. But the technology is just impossibly cool.
Yeah, so we have the video going. Why don't you give us the audio too, Victor?
The DJI goggles are designed for easy FPV flying, providing both seamless control and crystal clear views.
So you can see there that
a pair of large, high-quality screens offer.
As they're showing the people in this video, sometimes they have the person who has the goggles on holding the remote control and piloting the drone, and sometimes they have someone else doing that. And that's actually significant under the FAA rules, because having the actual goggle wearer flying the drone is right out unless you get a specific waiver from the FAA that you can do that. Otherwise,
as if anybody's going to buy this and not do that.
Right. Exactly. That's my point in bringing it up today. It certainly DJI doesn't seem to be making a distinction here. Sometimes they have the goggle wearer flying and sometimes they don't. But as far as the FAA is concerned, if you are going to fly using first-person view goggles, if you are going to fly anything that's not line of sight, you know, you as the pilot, you have to have a visual observer. And that visual observer has to be able to see the drone. I mean, that's the whole point of the visual observer, which throws into the mix here, too, these DJI Phantoms, at least, and probably other drones, too. I found an article that tested one out. They wanted to see what its maximum range could be, and they were getting 4+ miles out of the thing. It was flying and sending back video from 4.2 miles away from where the pilot was standing. Yeah. So line of sight doesn't happen in that kind of scenario. So apparently, despite, you know, the marketing that we're seeing here and the technology that's available, as far as the FAA is concerned, operators are supposed to limit their flights to only line of sight, or you're supposed to have a visual observer. And they're supposed to keep the thing in line of sight. So, again, this is just sort of another example of we saw this in the drone racing world where they were going to have to figure out how they were in compliance with FAA rules. And now, you know, as this kind of technology, as you say, Sean, is more and more marketed to the consumer, so is everybody else.
Right.
So something to watch. Any thoughts, Matt?
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting to over the next 10 years. I think that there's real I've seen some initiatives for actually mapping out on GPS coordinates where property lines are, specifically around airports and, you know, to build in a backdoor map that actually restricts you from going into these areas. I think that's technologically feasible over the next 10 years, and I think that in terms of maximizing privacy and yet allowing individuals to travel certain areas with their drones, I think that, you know, futuristically looking in the next 5-10 years, I think that's the way to go.
So let me, I think I understand what you're saying. I know we've talked about this before on the show, sort of these virtual barriers for drones. So the way you're envisioning things working is you would, you know, take off with your drone, and your drone, like Sean was saying, it has some various automation built into it, some self-piloting features. If it encountered a geofence, it would just go around it.
It would go around it or go back to the user. I think that, I mean, people, like we were just talking about, people want to use these more than the line of sights, and the technology is going to be able to go further. You have to have these sort of geofencing if you're going to move the technology in a safe way. And something that restricts boundary lines. We've got a bunch of nuclear power or two nuclear power plants around here. We can't have drones around there. You know, and they already do this with, you know, when we have a football game at Notre Dame, you know, there's a 1,000-mile radius. I think that this is something that would allow local areas to put in restrictions. And I think this applies to surfing, too. If the local community wants to pass a zoning ordinance, the drones can't fly there. They would put in a geofencing. I know that that NASA has been looking into piloting a program to fund this research to be able to do this. I'm not sure how far along they are. That's something I could check into for next week, though.
Yeah, that's really interesting, and I would be interested to know what NASA's doing with this as well, because it's kind of a departure, just as flying drones are sort of a departure from other aircraft, right? There are, if you're going to fly an actual airplane, there are a whole lot more regulatory compliance issues that you have to face.
You also have the skin in the game factor.
you're
which,
on board.
Which is a big factor. I've flown in small planes, and you don't take risks when you're in them. So.
Right. Exactly. You do. You definitely have a self-interest there that you know, if you crash your drone into somebody's property might be not as severe. Although I don't know if you guys have ever priced those DJI Phantoms. You don't want to crash them if you bought one.
No, you do not.
Not cheap.
One thing that caught many people off guard in 2017 is when Google announced plans to link online activity with offline purchases. We talked about this with lawyer Zoe Argento.
So there's a story that broke this week that I think sort of, it certainly, we were talking before the show, caught a bunch of us by surprise. I'm assuming if it caught us by surprise, it caught a lot of people by surprise. And that is this notion that Google and others are finding ways to take your online activity and link it to your offline activity. Now, Google says that it is doing this and that its technology enables it to do this in a way that connects up data about its anonymized users and not about you, Dan Coates, or whatever your name may be specifically. What it is doing that broke this week is taking credit card purchases, real world credit card purchases, and providing its advertisers, its clients, its customers, with information that links those purchases back to their advertising strategy with Google. In other words, if you've posted an ad, your furniture store, say, and you want to know if Google users are seeing that ad, clicking on that ad, and then coming into your store and purchasing things, that's what Google says that it's going to be able to deliver to its advertiser customers. It is going about this through its analytics, innovations, and machine learning capabilities, which are growing by leaps and bounds. If you've been paying attention to the world of AI and Go, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And specifically, Google, in addressing its customers, over 1,000 marketers from around the world attending Google Marketing Next. It has a blog post from Sridhar Ramaswamy, its senior vice president of ads and commerce, specifically addressing those people, but of course available for all of us to see what they're up to too. And one of the things they're up to is attempting to deliver to their advertising customers this connection between the ads that they place and the purchases that people may be prompted to make after having been influenced by those ads. One of the things the blog post says, tells these customers of Google's, is that if they're collecting email information at the point of sale for their loyalty programs, they can import store transactions directly into AdWords themselves or through a third-party data provider. But even if their business doesn't have a large loyalty program, they can still measure store sales by taking advantage of Google's third-party partnerships, which capture approximately 70% of credit card and debit card transactions in the United States, as Technology Review wrote about that particular factoid. So if you buy stuff with a card, there's a less than 1 in 3 chance that Google doesn't know about it. So with that information, they go on to tell their customers there's no time-consuming setup or costly integrations required on their end. They also don't need to share any customer information. This is what Google's telling them. After they opt in, they can automatically report on their store sales in AdWords. Both solutions leading back to the customer's collection of email and putting it in manually into AdWords. Both solutions match transactions back to Google Ads in a secure and privacy-safe way and only report on your aggregated and anonymized store sales to protect your customer data. So, Zoe, what do you think about all this?
Yeah, so it's interesting, and as you said, a bit surprising. So, I mean, I think one of my questions in hearing this is trying to understand exactly how it works, you know, because in privacy law, the devil is really in the details about exactly what you're doing. And of course, companies are often loath to give those details in describing exactly what they're doing. So, you know, just reading this description, the way I understand, sorry for all the puffing. Let me put this down a little. The way I understand how this is working is that probably, I'm guessing that the third parties that Google is getting the credit card transaction information from are the credit card processors, who often serve as middlemen between the acquiring bank, which is the account, the bank that maintains the merchant's bank account, and the merchant. And I'd imagine that's the case because my impression is that industry is highly consolidated. So Google might just have to partner with a few players to get up to 70% of credit card information. And then I suppose that Google is matching the names of its users, you know, based on profile information for its accounts, with the names on the credit cards. Because I don't think, and I can't, God knows, you know, Google collects a lot of information, but I don't think that Google is collecting names in a reliable fashion, just generally, unless someone opens an account and, you know, puts that in their profile information in Google, at least in kind of a consistent way. Though, of course, please let me know if I'm wrong. So I'm guessing what Google is doing here is that they're tying the names that they have on these user accounts to the names on the credit cards. And so, you know, I think that makes me wonder, you know, how accurate this is. In part, you know, it's probably accurate a good amount of the time, but I know for me personally, the name on my credit card is not the name on my Google account. You know, I try to be tricky and put a different name in. So I guess I would wonder, I guess it's kind of a global question about, you know, exactly how is this working in practice? And then Google says it sets up this kind of double blind encryption process or double blind security process so that the actual information about, you know, the names of the Google's users aren't revealed to the merchants. So they don't know that, you know, Zoe Argento went in and bought, you know, was looking online for, I don't know, a lawnmower and then went into the store and bought a lawnmower. They just know that a certain percentage of people who went and looked at advertisements that they placed went in and bought, you know, a particular product. So I think, you know, that's roughly the way it would work. Go ahead.
There's a lot to unpack in what you just said, and I want to try and suss some of it out. First of all, you raise a good point that maybe Google doesn't know your name if you don't have a Google account. Now, I don't know how many people who use Google regularly, and certainly if you're using all of it, the rest of its services besides search, you're going to have a Google account, right? You need one for email and YouTube and everything else. So there probably is a subset of people who don't have Google accounts and maybe using Google somewhat anonymously. You raise the idea that perhaps it's possible for them to know the names of users who are using the service just for search and don't have an account. I wonder if it has technology that could figure that out. I wouldn't be terribly surprised to learn that it did, but it's certainly not something that they're going into any detail about here in this blog post as to how they're putting this together. The other thing they would not be going into any detail about here, number one, because it would be proprietary, and number two, because I think it would freak the heck out of people, is exactly what you're speculating about here, Zoe, that they are matching up real world credit card names with real world Google accounts, and that they at least have a database that knows in a very non-anonymized way, if you're right, if you clicked on an ad. Or I wonder if they know, to what extent they know at least that an ad was displayed to you. Because I think that that, again, is something you can parse, that people see ads online and perhaps are influenced by them without ever clicking on them. So I wonder how Google parses that data as well. But in any event, whether they're knowing whether they displayed it to you or you clicked on it, if they are matching up your named identified Google account with a named identified credit card account, I think that would give a lot of people pause, but it's probably a likely way that this is working, as you say. And then the other thing I thought that we should unpack a little bit is people, you know, I think you're in the minority, Zoe, of people who would use a different name on their Google account than on their credit card.
Well, I am maybe a privacy lawyer.
Yes, exactly. but it's not probably not a bad idea. Mike, what were you going to add?
Well, yeah, I found this to be somewhat astonishing. And Zoe, it seems like you're exactly right that this information must be getting obtained from the processors, which, as you alluded to, are the ones that process these transactions. But I'm surprised to hear that processors would be allowed, if that's indeed how they're getting this information, that processors would be allowed to share any information regarding a transaction that you did with your local convenience store or, you know, local furniture store or whatever. What's the situation there? Are processors able to disclose information about your transactions? They must be able to if that's how this information is getting shared.
Right. So I think it really largely depends on the contractual obligations that the credit card processors have. So kind of the big set of contractual obligations that are pushed down on credit card processors are the payment card industry data security standards. So you may be familiar with these. These are called PCI DSS. And so any merchant basically has to know about this, and it's usually a very painful subject that they hate. So basically, this is a long set of data security standards that anyone who's dealing with credit card information in any way is supposed to comply with. It does not have force. It's not, you know, passed by a statute. It's a set of contracts. So the credit card brands have come up with this, and then they push it down by contract to the acquiring banks, which push it down by contract. You know, they're required in the contract with the credit card brands to push it down to the merchants. And it also gets pushed down to the credit card processors. But nowhere in the payment card industry data security standards does it say that you can't disclose credit card information. It just says that if you do disclose it, you have to make sure that the same kind of contractual obligations are pushed down to the party who's using that information. So I don't know, you know, precisely what's in all the contracts with the credit card processors, and, you know, who knows, there might be some obligations along those lines of non-disclosure, which, you know, they may have had to try to figure out and deal with in order to do this deal with Google. But certainly there would be a requirement that, you know, any party that they're sharing this information with apply data security standards. You know, it's just a lot of stuff like having a firewall and, you know, login credentials to your system.
Lawyer and host of the Opening Arguments podcast, Andrew Torres, joined Mike Keyes, Matt Curtis, and me for a rousing discussion of weird things you can trademark, such as the word covfefe and devil horn hand gestures. But you have already posted, not on Dr. Seuss, but on iconic 70s rock band Kiss and its frontman Gene Simmons, who also had an interesting trademark registration application. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. So this falls into the what in the covfefe is going on here? I know Matt loves to talk about covfefe, but it's
just like you love to talk about PETA.
As we talked about last week, there's a huge surge of covfefe trademark applications before the PTO, most if not all of which are likely to be denied. And this most recent one by Gene Simmons that was filed, I think it was either earlier this week or maybe late last week, I think falls into that covfefe dustbin. What he has done is Kiss and, frankly, a variety of rock bands over the last several decades have used the devil horn sign to, you know, express themselves during the course of their shows. Of course, the devil horn sign is this. I guess some debate whether the thumb should be out or not. But in any event, Gene Simmons has filed a trademark application with the United States Patent and Trademark Office to trademark that for entertainment services, claiming that he came up with it on his own back in the 1970s or thereabouts. and that it is a source identifier identified exclusively with him and his entertainment services that he has provided. So I think there are lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of other people that would dispute that claim. I think this is likely to be rejected by the examiner. The examiner will be looking at all sorts of outside evidence to see if this could possibly act as a source identifier, and it will quickly, he or she will quickly realize, if they haven't already, that this sign is used in a variety of contexts. It's actually used for signing "I love you." It's also used by a variety of rock bands and other people to express themselves during rock shows. So I don't think this is identified exclusively with Mr. Simmons or anybody else for that matter. But, you know, hey, he wanted to file the application. He had to pay a few hundred bucks to the federal government. So why not?
Yeah, I think that he actually would have a better shot if he'd put the thumb over the two fingers, right? Because then it wouldn't look like Shaka Bra from Hawaii and or California surf culture. Right. But the drawing they submitted has the thumb extended, as does the picture, I guess, they submitted with Gene Simmons and Dave Grohl illustrating the would-be trademark in action. Andrew, do you agree this one's going to go down in flames?
So, two things. Number one, It's definitely thumb over the fingers for the devil horn. Okay. I say this as somebody who came of age in the 1980s. And number two, I think the court can take judicial notice of the fact that Ronnie James Dio invented the devil horns. We all know that. So, I think there's prior art here.
Lawyer Peter Torin got together with Matt Curtis and me to discuss a Swiss case in which defamation law was applied broadly to impose a fine for liking someone else's comment on Facebook.
Another really interesting case, and one with, again, pretty broad ramifications should any other court decide to go this way. But over in Switzerland, there was a gentleman who has been held liable for defamation for having liked a comment on Facebook that he did not make. The comment apparently was accusing another party. There was some sort of controversy involving animal welfare folks and vegans and a protest, and there was a person involved in that controversy who had made racist comments and had some sort of prior conviction as well. And the party who got fined here disliked that person and agreed that he had been racist and out of line and therefore liked some comments to that effect, and found himself on the wrong end of a defamation claim. And the court said that by clicking the like button, the defendant clearly endorsed the unseemly content and made it his own, the court's statement said. The judge ruled that the defendant had failed to prove that the comments he had liked on Facebook were true. At the same time, by liking the comments, the man had disseminated them to his list of Facebook contacts and thus made them accessible to a large number of people. So this seems like a really, really tenuous basis for a defamation determination. And the lawyer for the party who was fined here, he was fined over $4,000 U.S., about $4,100 U.S. He desperately wants the courts to clarify whether hitting a like button on social media should be given the same weight as other forms of speech more commonly cited in defamation cases. The lawyer went on to say, if the courts want to prosecute people for likes on Facebook, we could easily need to triple the number of judges in this country. They could also obviously easily become an assault on the freedom of expression. So fascinating case. I have a hard time with it. Obviously, I think that simply liking something that someone else has said is problematic as a basis for a defamation claim, but I can almost see how the court cobbled this together in its mind, much as I can almost see how a court might struggle with the cues that are being offered when emojis are offered up for interpretation. We've talked about that much on the show lately, that the Facebook like maybe falls into that same kind of category. Here the court said, the defendant clearly endorsed the unseemly content and made it his own. Is that what a like means? This court thought so. What do you think, Matt?
I think that thankfully in the United States, we would not get into that question. There's a case that came out last week. It was Packingham versus North Carolina, in which North Carolina had a law that prohibited all sex offenders from going on to social media. There was a loosely defined term, but under the First Amendment, Justice Kennedy and the four liberal justices said that it was inherent to the dignity of being a person that you can be on social media. So I can't imagine that they would say that in that situation and also hold that that liking something, even bad speech or even racist speech or, you know, terrible speech would be criminalized. So I don't think we have to go down that road, but I thought it was funny that they said that they'd have to hire three times as many judges.
Yeah, I hope you're right. I don't know that I see it, you know, as quite as clear cut that courts would be, oh, yes, of course, if being on social media is a fundamental human right, that it necessarily follows that you can like anything that you want and not have it somehow become an endorsement or a statement. I think those are apples and oranges maybe, but I do think it's fascinating. Peter, want to weigh in?
Yeah, I am. I've been thinking about this, and I'm going to take a little bit of a contrary position to this, to the extent mm-hmm. if it involves defamatory speech, because it's different from the case that you like if you like hate speech or attack on somebody like that. And certainly, there's a First Amendment for protection for that kind of speech, but there is no First Amendment protection for defamatory speech. And if you're liking defamatory mm-hmm. speech, it involves a republication of the defamatory speech to, as the court in this particular case pointed out, that it was being circulated among his friends that were on his list, that he got all the likes on, that all his friends saw the defamatory speech. So there is a certain aspect here of republication that to me suggests that under certain circumstances where it's widely disseminated, I'm not so sure that the issue here isn't as clear cut as has been suggested. So I'm kind of in the minority on that position.
Wouldn't you need to prove that the individual knowingly know that the information was false and also that they did it with malice in order to do that? Or would it change if it's a private individual?
If it's a private individual, there's no malice involved. But they would have to have some knowledge about the intent and knowledge of the truth and veracity of the statement. So I was assuming that part of the defamatory, if the person broadly knows that it's a defamatory statement and goes ahead and recirculates it, republishes it, I think there's a possibility that even a court in the United States under similar circumstances would find that as defamation. That's just, I think there are a lot of factors that would go in 99% of the cases involving somebody hitting a like button on Facebook, the court would come to the conclusion that that's not defamation. But I think, again, maybe I'm thinking about the one in a millionth possibility, but I think there's a possibility that under a unusual set of facts, there may be defamation.
Yeah, I think I'm with you, Peter. And I come down to there are just a couple of complicating factors that technology is injecting here that make it hard for courts to do this kind of analysis. And that's why I do think that you could find it. I think this ruling is looked at as kind of an outrageous outlier, but maybe it's not, based on the fact that I think courts might have a hard time deciding, you know, what does a like really mean? What are you doing when you do that? Are you speaking? Are you endorsing? Are you, you know, fill in the blank? There was something else. Second point fled my brain. If it comes back to me, I'll let you know. I know. Actually, there are three points here, because of course, defamation involves, you know, spreading the defamatory comment, and whether you've liked something. You were starting to touch on that, Peter. You know what that means. What mechanism is triggered from the distribution standpoint when you hit like? You know, how do you know, or do you even know, who's going to see that you have liked that? Mm-hmm. And then finally, you injected, Matt, the really interesting aspect of whether you'd have to show malice or not, and that all goes to whether someone is a public figure or not. If the person allegedly defamed bringing the claim is a public figure, then you do have to show that. And if they're not, then you don't. And I have thought it was fascinating for ever since I started publishing a blog in the early 2000s, that figuring out who's a public figure these days is nigh impossible, because many, many more people have a presence online or otherwise that makes them in one way or another, not strictly speaking, a completely private citizen. They have some sort of public or social persona that I think courts haven't by any means decided how that impacts whether you're a public figure or not for purposes of that malice standard. So fascinating witch's brew of issues brought up by that case in Zurich.
Lawyer Maria Spear Aulis joined Mike Keyes, Matt Curtis, and me in discussing breakfast cereals and trademarking colors.
Moving on to the ubiquitous circle, it must drive Cheerios crazy, and I imagine maybe it's had other litigation about this, that there are so many other breakfast cereals out there that are a circle made out of beige-colored wheat of some kind that are not Cheerios. As Maria's pointed out, there are Corn Pops and Trader Joe's O's and toasted whole grain oats and honeycombs and honeyed cornflakes that all use the color yellow, which is also associated with Cheerios. But a lot of them use the circle, too. So I imagine this has been a long battle for Cheerios, although I don't know that much about it, trying to protect their own brand and what they do. What they have recently not been able to do is lock up the color yellow as theirs and theirs alone to use when it comes to these kinds of breakfast cereals. Right, Maria?
Yep. I wish I knew whether Cheerios has tried to protect the shape of those O's. There probably would be some kind of functionality issue there, but you know, trying to protect that color yellow and a couple of the things the TTAB cited, I wonder if they were specifically looking for O-shaped cereals, and they kind of listed a few images of the different O cereals that also use yellow, kind of showing that there's no secondary meaning there. Nice try, Cheerios, I guess. But apparently their brand manager says the battle's not over, so maybe they'll keep on trying.
Right. And then this isn't the first time we've looked at cases where a brand has said that color is ours. The two that are mentioned in the Adweek piece that we have in our discussion points are Tiffany and then also Louboutin, the very high-end high-heeled shoe maker, which did get some recognition vis-a-vis Yves Saint Laurent, that they have a distinctive shoe with this red sole. But the court didn't go quite so far as to say you are the only shoe manufacturer that can have a red sole. So it's a little bit confusing how they left things there. At least I'm a little confused. Can you set me straight, Maria?
I think that in that decision, they had to revise their application a little bit, and they ended up with having a valid, you know, trade dress protection in that red sole, so long as the shoe itself is not red. There was no secondary meaning if the entire shoe was red, but in a shoe that is not red, you know, they kind of have that acquired distinctiveness, I guess.
Yes, that would be a very aggressively red shoe to have the whole thing, including the sole, be red. Though I guess it's possible. Any thoughts about Cheerios, Matt?
Yeah, I think that one of the problems with trademarking colors, and I know it's limitedly been accepted by the courts, is that the color spectrum is a limited amount of space on it. So when you're looking at a competitive area like a cereal box, I'm sure it's very valuable. I believe it went up to the Supreme Court previously whether trademark should be used on college athletics uniforms when they were looking at infringement by third parties, and I believe they said that they could. But it seems like always a tricky area of the law to cut off a unique color spectrum and probably like colors in the area. So I think it was always an uphill battle for Cheerios.
Right, and I think, you know, tying this back to the fact that we do a technology law show here, that this does impact how people present themselves online, that these color schemes are very important when it comes to user experience and UI design. Imagine, for example, if Google tried to keep any other website from being clean and white, which is, you know, such a part of its presentation. Mike, any thoughts on how these color issues transfer over to the online world?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, color, of course, can be protectable as a trademark. The U.S. Supreme Court has made that clear under certain circumstances. You know, you've got to be able to establish that you have a protectable, that essentially it has secondary meaning with respect to a particular segment of the market. So, you know, colors can be very powerful, just a single color. I mean, think of the color that Tiffany uses. I mean, it's you know, the color in and of itself can be a very powerful indicator of source. So one thing I did want to mention, the discussion about the Cheerio box reminded me of the 1938 case that went all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court, Kellogg versus Nabisco over shredded wheat. There the court actually talked about functionality of, once a patent has expired with respect to the shredded wheats, Kellogg was able to reproduce it. So it just kind of got me thinking about that. Fun little fact for the day, 1938 Supreme Court case over Cheerios.
That's a good one.
For bringing that in, yes. All right. Well, bringing ourselves
into court.
The opinion was written by Justice Brandeis, no less. Oh. A legal giant that was opining on breakfast cereal. So
we were fortunate enough to be joined by the Honorable Thomas E. Delahanty II, who helped us understand how one becomes a United States attorney.
You personally, Tom, had some brush with the federal government wishing to protect your privacy in the context of your resignation from your position as U.S. attorney. Maybe it would be helpful for you to describe, you alluded earlier that you had held the position of U.S. attorney for Maine earlier on under the Carter administration. For folks who aren't terribly familiar with, you know, how people get that job and keep that job, maybe you could start from square one and describe the political appointment process and what happens when we have a change in administration.
Okay. Well, more recently, as I was terminated, I had a friend say, gee whiz, it's too bad you have to lose your job because of politics. And my answer was, well, you know, that's kind of how I got the job in the first place, was a little bit of politics being involved. But every person who is appointed to this position, and there are 93 United States attorneys. Many states have one, and some of the larger states like California have, and Texas and Florida have as many as three or four United States attorneys divided up into districts. But Generally speaking, when there is a change in administration, you expect that your term is going to end, even if it's the same party, because the president who is coming in has a right to appoint the people that he or she would feel would be appropriate for the job. Most often it is when there is a change in political party. 35 years ago when that happened, when Reagan defeated Carter, I had been there a short time, but I knew that there was going to be a change. And not long after the inauguration, I did submit my resignation. And one of the options we were given was to submit your resignation effective on the appointment of a successor. And that's what I did. And I was able to stay until about mid-August. A new person was appointed, whom I knew very well. And when he got sworn in, I left. And but it led to a smooth transition. The office was a lot smaller then, but the I was able to work with the people in the office and plan for moving the cases on with a new person as United States Attorney. And the United States Attorney is the chief federal law enforcement officer in the state. Not that the U.S. Attorney or even the assistants are going out doing investigations, but we oversee policy and procedure. And each administration is responsible for perhaps bringing in their own particular policies regarding certain issues. And when the opportunity came more recently after President Obama was sworn in, I was one of more than a dozen people who were interviewed for the job. I was one of four people whose names were sent to Washington for consideration. I was fortunate enough to be selected, and then you go through a vetting process, interviews. But from the initial interview until I was actually sworn in was about 17 months. And Maine did not have a Democratic senator at the time, and the states with Democratic senators were generally getting taken care of ahead of time. But I was about in the middle of the pack as far as the numbers are concerned. And but once I got there, some of the things were very familiar, but mostly because of technology, the actual prosecution of cases and the investigation of cases had changed so much. And then what happened this time, the United States attorneys, they had the choice of, for a while, whether we wanted to stay or leave. Approximately half of the United States attorneys had resigned and left to go into other positions. Some went into teaching, some into private practice, either before or shortly after the inauguration. There were about half of us who, having been told that we would have the opportunity to stay until a person was named and approved to succeed us, that we decided that we would do that because, in my personal case, I thought it would help the transition. I would be able to finish up some of the cases that the office was working on. And but then eventually a new U.S. attorney would come in, and perhaps there'd be some changes in policy and procedures. It was completely unexpected that we would be terminated so abruptly. I actually was on vacation with my family in Florida, and they got a phone call saying we expect your resignation by midnight tonight. I didn't get it to them until the following week because they wanted it mailed. I didn't have access to my computer or printer, and I was terminated anyway, so it really didn't matter when the actual letter went in. But what happened after that, I think it was about mid-May, the USA Today and some of its subsidiary newspapers were seeking to get a copy of the letters that we sent in I don't know specifically what they were looking for. Maybe they were hoping for some pithy remarks that people made about the president of the administration. But the Department of Justice would not release the letters saying that there was too much personal information. Letters of resignation were personal. And that was really a surprise to, I think, many of us, and certainly the ones that I talked to, who in my letter said, basically, I resign as instructed. It was a pleasure to serve under the presidents Carter, Reagan, and especially Obama, and I resign. I do know another U.S. attorney that I talked to expressed a surprise for the time and did mention that it impeded the an orderly transition. But the Justice Department would not release them, saying there was too much personal information in there. I was eventually contacted by a reporter from the Burlington, Vermont Free Press, which is a subsidiary of USA Today, asking if he could get a copy of my letter. And I said, yes. I sent him a copy, as did another U.S. attorney. And the only thing I did is I deleted my personal phone number, personal email, and home address, more for security reasons than privacy. But, I mean, it was public knowledge that I had been let go. And, you know, every U.S. attorney knows that when you are originally appointed, you don't have the job for forever or going into new administrations. Virtually all of the U.S. attorneys were allowed to stay in when President Obama was reelected, but that's kind of the practice. And it can vary from administration to administration. And if the present administration had asked me and other U.S. attorneys to please resign by the day of the inauguration on January 20th, we would have expected that. What mm-hmm. happened here was, having been led to believe we would be able to stay for a while and help on the transition, the suddenness was very strange. And then these newspapers, they have a FOIA request into the Justice Department that I understand has not yet been acted on, and it may be leading to litigation. then that's pretty much what's happened. So in 46 United States Attorney's offices, the person who had been acting as the first assistant became the acting United States Attorney. So it was the suddenness of it that really surprised everybody.
Lawyer and podcaster Gabby Ziccarelli joined Matt Curtis, Emery Roan, and me to discuss the hazards of disrespecting the Wu-Tang Clan and selling its exclusive CD. So we had Martin Shkreli in the show last week as our tip of the week. The tip then being don't solicit assault because you could wind up losing your bail and wind up in jail or otherwise wind up in jail. This was over his Facebook post asking people to putting a bounty on Secretary Clinton's hair as she goes around and does her book tour. That was ill-advised. It seems this whole Wu-Tang album thing seems to have been really ill-advised as well. Let's catch you up if you're not up on what happened in 2015. Part of the reason that Martin Shkreli is notorious is not just for his price gouging in the pharmaceutical industry, but because he bought this supposed Wu-Tang album that was a limited edition CD. And here's where we get to whether or not people still listen to CDs. I guess this is one way in which they do, that came in this amazingly gaudy and elaborate packaging and sold at auction to Martin Shkreli for $2 million. And at that point, his rights that he purchased with that album were basically that he could do anything he wanted to with it except sell it
I didn't look at all of the terms, sell copies of it. So if you wanted to release it into the, you know, to let the world's Wu-Tang Clan fans listen to it, he could do it, I think, as long as it was non-commercial. But no, he's chosen not to do that. And in fact, since he's fallen on such hard times and taken to soliciting assault, he decided to sell said $2 million album that he bought, CD in the weird case. But unfortunately, now that he's on hard times, there he is. If you're watching the video, he posted it on eBay with a very pathetic photo of himself and a note saying he's selling it. He fetched just over $1 million for it, so lost about $1 million on it. And now there's this swirling controversy about whether it even is a Wu-Tang Clan album. So in the midst of all his legal woes, Martin Scully might have to be hiring someone to look into whether he got what he paid for, whether there was some sort of breach of contract involved when he bought the thing, some sort of fraud in the inducement of the purchase. Because now there is a bunch of speculation that no, this wasn't even what we would think of as a Wu-Tang Clan album. And there's a very detailed piece at Bloomberg that we have in our discussion points, which you can review at your leisure at tagpacker.com/user/thisweekinlaw. Find episode 400 there. And it goes through the various arguments and assertions and firsthand accounts by people who were involved in tracks that went on to this thing about why it's not maybe perhaps a Wu-Tang album. I kind of got lost in the weeds in that article, so I'm going to let others try and sort all that out. Emery, thoughts?
Like, I am not going to disrespect the Wu-Tang Clan, so I don't want to say anything inappropriate.
that was why one of the jurors got bounced from Scully's trial. Yeah, he thought that he was guilty and had done it, and he wasn't going to let him slide out of anything. And then he added, and he disrespected the Wu-Tang Clan. you should. Out. Weren't you just on call for jury duty yesterday, Emery? Yeah,
I should have.
Yep. One to file away. So Once Upon a Time in Shaolin still has not been listened to by the public at large. Scarelli himself said he didn't listen to it at length or something like that.
I think it's interesting. He did say in the eBay listing that he covenanted that he would destroy any copies that he'd made. It's just kind of interesting. I don't know. I haven't really processed this entirely, but he's not only selling the exclusive limited print CD, but he's selling, apparently, according to him, the only copy of the CD that he bought. And I guess he could have made a copy of, but
right.
I don't know. This is getting...
Shades of the Redigi case, right? They're technology, whether you can resell digital files, involves assurances that copies of those files are not going to persist when they are resold. So fascinating Wu-Tang related story. Matt, thoughts?
Oh, I'm going to go with Emery here and not disrespect the Wu-Tang. There was just a lot going on in the network of building an album with people across the country and across networks, really brings in like vast copyright problems in general, especially when you're not advising your other, if you're not being integrous with your other co-creators of what you're actually making. So there would be an interesting claim here, but it's not in the public knowledge of who the copy itself. So. It'll be interesting to see if the purchaser releases this, and then I would imagine that we'll be hearing more about this.
this Bloomberg piece is just full of gems. First of all, we have Domingo Neris, who's on record saying it's not an authorized Wu-Tang Clan album. Domingo is the manager of rapper U God, a charter member of the Clan. He says it never was an authorized art album. So we're going to get Domingo and others testifying, I guess, in Skrelly's favor when he goes to say, you sold me a bill of goods here, Wu-Tang Clan. And then the Bloomberg actually tried to discuss Once Upon a Time in Shaolin with Martin Shkreli. He responded to an email earlier this week, the article says, with ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha-ha- he called them overpriced legacy software that subsidizes a money-losing media company, and declined to talk to them. So, Gabby, anything else you want to add here?
I have so many IP questions. You know, I have to tell you. So my thought initially reading this, okay, first of all, what qualifies as a true Wu-Tang album? Because when you're reading this story, it sounds as though a lot of members of the Wu-Tang came in, thought they were doing a feature on someone else's album, but some kind of knew that other people were participating. So how do we define that? I was thinking in my own terms, okay, if the two original members of Destiny's Child who got booted were to release some album and maybe Beyonce was on one song, is that a Destiny's Child album? So, you know, where do we, what does that mean when we think about what a band is now versus yesteryear? But also looking even at that very intricate case that was provided in the purchase, who authorized the use of that? I assume it's trademarked. I don't know for sure, for certain. But doesn't Wu-Tang have to make sure that they are policing their mark? If this isn't authorized, there's a lot of IP issues here too. So for me, there's a lot to unravel.
You know what else this reminds me of? And I forget her name. And I forget, it was, what was the name of the movie? You guys will remember. But there was an actress who sued for having done a part in a movie on false pretenses.
Oh.
Remember her? She was told one thing, but the movie was about something else. It was about something related to the Muslim faith. Oh. And yeah. And she sued and she lost, as I recall. So as far, and we're going to, somebody and I remind me, or somebody remind me what this case was all about. But yeah, the movie that caused, thank you, Dr. Morbius, the Benghazi attack, or was associated with that. This sort of recording me or recording my performance under false pretenses argument seems to raise its head here as well with these plan members.
Too, or I assume, were there just a verbal, hey, come in and I want you to just be on my track, it's my mixtape? Or was, you know, what was the conversation? And also, the record label that owns the rights to Wu-Tang, I'm just curious if they've spoken up officially, if anybody knows, because you would think they'd want to jump in and really examine this piece.
Yeah, absolutely. Matt, give us your thoughts. Innocence of Muslims was the movie. Actress was, hold on, I'm pulling her up, but meanwhile, weigh in for us, Matt.
My assumption is that these sort of arrangements, I would have assumed that the Wu-Tang clan would have been a little more prepared for this, but this is the way that music and creation and collaboration happens. It doesn't happen with lawyers and contractual agreements. It happens with people getting together and making things and selling them. But I am surprised that they do not have some sort of formal agreement. At least that's not outlined in Bloomberg. But I do think the trademark is really interesting. If they're not actually protecting their trademark and it's a loose collection of people who can use it, what's the value?
Right.
Interesting.
Her name was Cindy Lee Garcia. And she attempted to extricate herself. She argued that it was an infringement of copyright law for them to use her performance in the film because they led her to believe that the movie was a historical adventure titled Desert Warrior. But instead, it's the movie that prompted the riots associated with Benghazi. So something the Wu-Tang Clan might want to consider, although Cindy Lee Garcia did not fare too well in her suit.
Lawyer Bill Donahue joined Matt Curtis and me to bow down to Velcro's legal team as they explain what is effing hook and loop.
We have a couple of great genericide stories in the lineup for this week. So let's start with the one with the funny lawyer video, shall we? This is hysterical. Bill, I'm assuming you put this in the rundown, and I'm so glad you did. I hadn't seen this yet. But Velcro is among the companies out there that wishes that you wouldn't call every single product Velcro that includes products that they themselves did not make. They would vastly prefer that you use a more generic term and not their brand name of Velcro to describe hook and loop fastening technologies and mechanisms. And much like the Netflix lawyers that we talked about last week, they have made the legal profession look pretty darn fun and relatable by putting out this video, and we're just going to play you some here. You think it's awesome for us, we're famous, but we're lawyers and it's causing us grief. Cause there are trademark laws being broken, it's all here in this short legal brief. And we know that this is confusing, because Velcro brand is who we are. What if you called all Velcro? We're gonna lose our circle R. This is called hook and loop. We're gonna lose our circle R. You call it Velcro, but we're begging you. This is f***ing hook and loop. I just love this thing. Bravo, Velcro. Bravo. Well played.
Yes, well done.
So their message is, you know, and they go on to talk about Clorox bleach and what did they say? Inline skating versus rollerblading. Very many other companies who have had their successful product name become the name of everything in the industry. And they don't want that to happen to them. Bill, my question for you, as someone who writes a lot about trademark law, should we be thinking about a change in the law here so that companies don't have to do this? Shouldn't they be able to keep their trademark even if their brand is so successful that every hook and loop fastening system is referred to commonly as Velcro?
Well, it's a hard question because, right, I think that the court cases that have dealt with genericide, they acknowledge that it's a really difficult situation because it's essentially punishing a company that's been so successful that they're losing their trademark. But at the same time, the policy function of genericide is that you don't want a company locking up terms that are ubiquitous, that are you know, part of the lexicon. It's a safety valve almost for trademark law, because trademark law does limit speech. It's in tension with the First Amendment. So, you know, sure, it is unfortunate if you are Thermos and you were so successful at selling vacuum sealed cooling tubes or whatever the generic term they would have preferred was, that's unfortunate for you. But it shouldn't, if that's the way that the public has come to view your term, I think it's an appropriate limitation on trademark law's restrictions on speech.
Yeah, I think it's a really tough issue. I really think that companies should be able to keep their trademarks and not be victimized by their own successes. But there are good reasons, I suppose, to just try and fight against the generatization of your brand. Matt, what do you think?
Yeah, I don't know what the origin of the law, and I have not read the cases, but just from an equity standpoint, I'm not sure, like, you know, Bill mentions that this is in conflict with free speech. Well, most of copyright is in conflict with like a pure free speech. And the question isn't like, can I stop a consumer from calling a non-Velcro branded hook and ladder or something, Velcro. It's whether the company that's in competition with them can say on their branding that this is Velcro. And to me, it doesn't seem like bad for consumer welfare in like an abstract perspective that like another company can't call, you know, like another company is making this sort of thing, can't call what they're calling it Velcro. I don't see why that particularly matters. It, you know, for consumers who aren't going to buy it because it's not called Velcro, even though it does the same thing, you know, maybe there's a pricing differentiation, but I would imagine that that's going to equal out. Once again, I've not read the cases on this, but it seems to me that there's not, you know, this isn't the First Amendment where we're talking about speech on politics or speech on anything else. This is where a company has you know, made up a name of something and want to be the only people to call their product that. And that doesn't seem unconstitutional to me. But
right. I think the argument would be that when it has reached this point where that we call genericide, that other companies for competitive purposes have a right to use a term that, you know, the question when it comes to genericism is whether it's understood by the relevant public primarily to refer to a genus of goods. So it's not like this is a step that you take lightly. It's not like most brands are being victimized by this. It's a situation where you truly are claiming ownership over a name that competing companies need to use to compete with you. So I think we need to shy away from the idea that this is, you know, that this is victimizing brands it's taking away people's trademark rights willy-nilly. I think it's mm-hmm. a very, very sort of nuclear option for a court to rule that a brand that once had the distinctiveness that required the source designating power of a trademark has lost it. I don't think that's a step that courts take lightly. So I don't think it's, you know, I don't think it's something I don't think it's a pressing problem.
Right? Yeah, I mean, it's kind of like paying high taxes. Like, yeah, you have to pay higher taxes, but that means you're making more money. And in the same vein, like, yeah, your trademark's being taken away, but that's because you did that. I think the origin question is whether, you know, what is the purpose of trademark? And if the purpose of trademark is for consumers to be able to differentiate between products on the basis of who's making them, then you're not taking it away from the company. You're taking away the differentiation from the consumer. Now, I don't think that there's a whole lot of, like, you know, I don't think anyone's a quote unquote victim in this situation. You know, they would be losing a property right, but they've dominated the market to such an extent that that's a real consideration. I don't think this is like hurting companies, like. You know, this isn't hurting innovation. This isn't hurting these kind of things. So I'm not overly worried about this. I agree with that. But I do think it's an interesting question about what it does to the market. And if there's any analysis about, you know, does competition actually increase when you take away the trademark? Does pricing come down? And if it doesn't, then what's the point?
Just before Apple launched the iPhone X, Privacy International's Scarlett Kim joined Matt Curtis, Mike Keyes, and me to discuss Face ID. Let's talk about Face ID, which hits the pockets of a lot of folks these days as the iPhone X begins shipping today. The Daily Mail in the UK wrote about many of the privacy concerns raised by Face ID, and we're going to talk about some of those right now. But it also wrote that Apple's introduction is likely to bring about widespread use of facial recognition technology in a way that we haven't seen before, even though facial recognition technology is in other things. This is going to make it a really ubiquitous kind of thing. It's going to inure people to biometrics in a way that they have not been used to before. And it's different than the kinds of biometrics we've used before. When you look at someone and you know they've given their fingerprint for various identification purposes or maybe to unlock their phone, you can't look at them and determine that
a fingerprint that you know about matches up with that person, but you can look at them and know that a face does. So it does change things in rather interesting ways. Scarlett, Privacy International does a lot of work on biometrics, so I'm wondering what your organization's take is on the new Face ID in the iPhone 10.
So I think to begin, what you're seeing is, you know, in general, I think the public is inured to trading away sort of bits and pieces of our identity expressed as data. And one thing to note is that biometric data is particularly sensitive data. I think the other thing to note is that there are a lot of narratives about the accuracy of biometric data. And I think that we should maybe interrogate those narratives a bit, because there are studies that have shown, for example, that rates of accuracy can really vary depending on, you know, the quality of the data that's collected. And also, for example, I think it was so Georgetown released this report, I think it was last year, called the Perpetual Lineup, that was about law enforcement use of facial recognition technology around the country. And they noted that actually for certain races, for example, facial recognition, the current state of facial recognition software is not necessarily as accurate as for other races. So to the extent that you're using facial recognition technology, it can maybe disproportionately affect certain groups in terms of how accurate the data can be. I think from our perspective, you know, our surveillance work focuses a lot on state surveillance. So we're primarily concerned with how states adopt and implement novel forms of technology. But I think, you know, there is this kind of private sector aspect to that, because often it's companies that are developing this technology, and that market will grow, and there will also be companies that will sell this technology to governments. And then the other kind of corporate government nexus is that when companies start to collect this data, it can create a honeypot for third parties, including governments. I think the other concerns are when facial recognition data is used, for example, to make inferences about people and then to make what we would describe as consequential decisions. We would consider consequential decisions to be those that might affect a person's right. You know, and that can include a broad range of rights. And this applies in both the private and the government context. So in the private context, you might imagine, for example, companies that use facial recognition or other biometric data to make decisions about a person's health or suitability for a job or suitability for a place at a public university, maybe. These are just random examples that are off the top of my head. But mm-hmm. on the state side of things, you could also imagine facial recognition technology being used in ways that could also infringe a broad range of rights. So again, referencing that Georgetown report, I believe there was discussion there about how there was no explicit prohibition among most law enforcement agencies for using facial recognition technology to police protests. So to use that technology to identify people attending protests. And obviously that could have a chilling effect on both the right to freedom of expression and freedom of assembly.
Right. And that Georgetown study that you mentioned also included that nearly half of all Americans are in a law enforcement database that includes facial recognition.
And that was in 2016, by the way. That was in 2016, the year that the FBI thumbprint database had been expanded to the next gen database to include biometrics and DNA and everything. So there's no indication that that number has decreased since 2016.
Right. Right. And yeah. And one thing that has changed since the last time we pondered the iPhone 10 and its Face ID here on This Week in Law is just yesterday we learned via Reuters, which got its hands on a developer agreement between Apple and a third party developer, that despite what Apple has been very discursive about since it announced the iPhone 10, and despite its responses to Senator Al Franken's concerns that he wrote an open letter to the company and said, hey, you know, you're going to have all this 3D facial identification information on people. Please assure us that that is only going to reside, you know, please tell us what you're going to do with that data and make sure that we feel good about that. And the response has been, well, it's only going to reside in a secure vault on the device itself. It's not even going to be on our servers. But it appears now, based on the terms of this contract that Reuters has seen, that Apple will allow developers to take certain facial data off the phone as long as they agree then to seek customer permission and not sell the data to third parties. So that seems problematic on any number of fronts. Just ticking down the list, the granting of customer permission, we talk a lot on the show about how things aren't read, people don't pay attention to the rights that they're giving away. Is this going to be buried in 20 pages of legalese? Is it going to be something meaningful as far as getting customer consent? That remains to be seen. And also this contractual stricture on Apple's developers, oh, please get consent and don't ever sell it. You know, that's a contractual stricture. So contracts are breached all the time. And there are some 2 million apps in the App Store. So it's going to be, I think, very difficult once this genie is out of the bottle and this facial data that was supposed to live only in the secure vault on your phone is in the hands of various and sundry third-party developers, for it not to wind up in law enforcement databases and not to wind up in marketing databases for people who want to market to you based on what your various facial expressions might be. It seems to be a big problem that just was made public yesterday. And as far as I know, Apple has not yet responded to what Reuters unearthed. So
it's important that I think, you know, even if Apple is not doing this, I mean, we haven't seen the contract. This is just what Reuters has reported. But even if Apple is not doing this, there's nothing to stop any of the other companies that are building facial recognition tech into their phones from having exactly this sort of language. So if we're not seeing it now with Apple, which, you know, again, I think that Apple has been as privacy focused as we could have hoped and as proactive as we could have hoped on building this correctly from the ground up. I think that I personally am at least far less confident that, you know, Huawei or any of the other numerous cheaper Android phones are going to be following the same best practices.
Yeah, I think that's a great observation. What do you think, Scarlett, of the fact that even though Apple doesn't want to do bad things with your data, it is going to allow third parties, apparently, if this Reuters report is accurate, to have access to that data?
Yeah, I mean, I think I agree with everything you and Emery have said. You know, I mentioned how this data can create sort of a honeypot for third parties, and I was thinking there more about perhaps unauthorized access. But what you're seeing here is a kind of proliferation creep, which you see in a lot of instances where there's this understanding that data might be confined to one place for one purpose, but it ends up kind of, it kind of ends up sort of in the hands of multiple parties. I guess I'm also curious, I mean, I don't know like what the sort of protected status is of biometric data, like of your face under US law. But there, I think there's this question about like if you're giving away that data to third party developers, if that means then that like you could have the state just act. I mean, this, I don't know if it engages the third party doctrine at all. I mean, I might be completely off base here, but with, you know, Carpenter v. U.S. going up to the Supreme Court, I think there is this question about all the things that we willingly give away, and I say willingly sort of sarcastically, but what users consent to in terms of giving away to third-party companies, how that actually affects also the way that we protect that information vis-a-vis the state.
Right. And I'm a little miffed at Apple, I guess, that in the course of, again, if this Reuters report turns out to be accurate, that in the course of addressing people's concerns over Face ID and privacy, they have not been forthcoming about this and saying secured vault on your phone. And oh, by the way, third parties too. That hasn't come up at all. Yeah. That seems a little sketchy to me. Mm-hmm. Mike, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, so I was just curious if anybody was familiar with any judicial decisions involving use of facial recognition in the context of fingering or pinpointing a particular criminal defendant. I'm not aware of any. It seems as though that issue is bound to come up at some point. And at that point, this Georgetown study or one of these other studies that shows the error rate associated with facial recognition seems like that could come into play to challenge this technology as a valid basis for using in a criminal defendant's trial.
Yeah, I can't think of a specific instance where that's happened. I know that we've seen at least reports that, you know, local highway police have been, you know, taking photographs or using, you know, applications that do some sort of biometric lookup. So I don't know particularly, but certainly it's going to be an issue if it isn't already.
Right.
Absolutely.
One of the things this Daily Mail piece does is talk about the fact that privacy advocates like Privacy International and others are trying to stave off the time when a law enforcement officer wandering the streets can have, you know, some sort of Google Glass overview or some sort of way of scanning the faces of people around them and knowing information about them just moving through crowds from face recognition databases. But I think that staving that off is about the best we can do. I think we are definitely headed toward it. Don't you, Scarlett?
Yeah, so one of the things that the Georgetown report found so troubling was just the lack of regulation around the use of the technology. And I also thought, I think they draw a kind of interesting distinction in the ways in which you might use this technology in permissible and impermissible ways. But because of the lack of regulation, those lines haven't been drawn clearly enough for example, law enforcement agencies. One permissible ways would include kind of targeted uses of facial recognition technology. So as a way of verifying, for example, the identity of a specific person. But ways in which we might consider impermissible, for example, would be if you have facial recognition software running over kind of a real-time surveillance camera. So it's basically scanning the faces of everybody walking in front of that camera.
We've seen that in China, right? I think aptly named, terrifyingly named Skynet system of CCTV cameras. They've just rolled out, or they are in the process of rolling out AI tools to improve the act of real-time live facial recognition through their CCTV cameras. I mean, that's as Big Brother as it gets, and it's real life right now today.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that it's not that hard to imagine similar uses of that technology if it continues unregulated in, for example, in the U.S. context as well.
Computer scientist Joshua Kroll joined me, Mike Keyes, and Emery Roan to discuss the Carpenter versus U.S. case and whether the Supreme Court will require law enforcement to obtain warrants before getting cell site location data. This has been called by many people the most important digital privacy case to come before the court, maybe ever, maybe this term. It certainly builds on some other recent important digital privacy cases that the Supreme Court has had. This one involved smartphone robberies, the prosecution of smartphone robberies, and the procurement of location data about the defendant from his cellular provider. That data was obtained without a warrant. It was used to convict him, and he was sentenced to 116 and a quarter years in federal prison. So the key issue in this case is particularly in the wake of some of the recent Supreme Court cases that we've seen on digital privacy, whether the fact that the data was being held by the third party cellular provider meant that Carpenter had waived his privacy rights, Fourth Amendment rights as to those bits of data, and law enforcement was just fine and dandy in obtaining it without a warrant. So that is what's at stake in the Supreme Court, argued this week. And Emery, yes.
I'm sorry, didn't miss that spirit. I didn't interrupt. Go right ahead. But the other issue in the case that the ACLU raises is that so specifically Carpenter, his cell site location data was used to convict him, but it wasn't just the day of the robbery. It was, in fact, the government pulled 117 days worth of his cell site location data from his cell phone provider, a total of something like it was in the order of tens of thousands of individual location requests, so that it amounted to hundreds of location requests per day for nearly half a year. And so the ACLU was trying to raise the argument of whether the fact that this is historical data makes it a distinction. But yeah, the underlying issue is really all about the third party doctrine. And so I think that we've talked about it before, but it's the third party doctrine is the idea that, you may have a reasonable expectation to certain information. But if you convey that information to a third party, sorry, Kat, get off of me. Oh, you're staying here. If you convey that information to a third party, then the information, then you lose that reasonable expectation of privacy. And that is a doctrine that goes back to 1970, to a 1977 case, but that I think that most people, when you think about it in the context of today, can recognize that there's some sort of underlying problems with that, at least in the face of the reality of our connected world. It is, very difficult, maybe impossible, to not give your data to a third party. And in fact, the idea of whether we're, consensually giving that data to a third party is controversial in itself. And so, we're not going to have a decision in Carpenter until probably June. But there is some really interesting analysis just of the oral arguments and the justices' responses to the oral arguments that is sort of worth discussing. It is obviously a huge issue. At the end of the day, we are continuing to operate under the assumption that if you have any kind of third party in between you and your cell phone, that, the government can just go to that third party without a warrant, just with a much lower bar as far as whether that data is. I'm sorry, guys. Cat.
It's okay. Well, while you deal with the cat, I'll just mention a really great quote that I spotted about the case that goes to write what you're saying, Emery, which is that the third party doctrine hinges on an interpretation of the Stored Communications Act of 1986. And in writing this up for The Hill, Adam Levin has this amazing quote about the Stored Communications Act and translating 1986 digital policy into 2017 and beyond digital policy. Remember the 80s? Needless to say, it's an old law that was written when mobile phones were the size of a Scottish terrier and the only people who had them were drug lords, Japanese real estate moguls, and Ivan Boesky. So yes. I think he makes Beautiful. The point that perhaps the justices should be thinking differently about these issues and about who has your data and what your expectations are about it than they might have been thinking in 1986. And that came through loud and clear in the oral argument, didn't it, Emery?
Yeah, so I actually haven't finished reading through the oral arguments. I've read a lot of analysis of the oral arguments, and I have begun to read through them. There's about 100 pages or so of that. I definitely recommend you checking it out. I will be finishing it this weekend. But I think when you first learn about the third-party doctrine as a law student, at least if you are maybe privacy-minded like myself, it sounds incredible, and it sounds totally incompatible with the modern world. But that is the state of the law that we've been operating under so far. So frankly, when I was reading about the Carpenter case beforehand, I was very much not optimistic at all. And it sounded pretty much like under the current understanding of the law that there's no real issue here that he gave his data to a third party. And again, whether or not the data even was his to give. So what we're talking about here is cell site location data. You know, is this information generated on the phone or is it generated at the ISP about your phone? And that's really interesting in itself. As far as predictions on how this is going to go down, so far I've read that Sotomayor and Gorsuch, or Sotomayor at least certainly seems like she's on the privacy side. Gorsuch put forth a really interesting privacy argument. He suggested that he proposed the question that, so, okay, if someone has their location data at Verizon and a thief breaks in to Verizon and steals that location data, or T-Mobile it was in his example, does that customer have a cause of action against the thief? And, you know, is there some sort of conversion theory, which implies that he would be willing to extend a property interest in the data that the third parties hold, which is just really unprecedented, would be kind of revolutionary, and it would really change the landscape of how we consider our private data. And yeah, it's something to follow. It's really interesting. I went from being entirely pessimistic about this to very cautiously optimistic that we're going to get a good result in June.
Yeah, definitely. It seems like there's no breakdown on party lines on this issue. Maybe there are different approaches taken by part of the court. There's a really good piece in The Atlantic by Jeffrey Rosen analyzing the oral argument. And he writes that the conservative justices might hold with Gorsuch that Congress has created a property interest in our geolocational data, that the Fourth Amendment prevents it from invading without a warrant. The more liberal justices might hold that we have an expectation of privacy in electronic data that prohibits the government from tracking us over long periods of time, regardless of whether our property rights are invaded. Some justices might even embrace both theories. It is inspiring, he writes, in any event, to see justices as diverse as Gorsuch and Sotomayor providing constitutional leadership about the urgent need to translate the Fourth Amendment into an electronic age. So
it's really interesting because we've always, in the privacy world, we've said forever that, oh, privacy is not a partisan issue. It shouldn't be a partisan issue. And yet it frequently is. But it does feel like that landscape is shifting, that, you know, more and more it's recognized that this is, you know, whether you want to come down this on a property interest or a individual liberty interest, this is a, you know, privacy crosses the political spectrum. So it's encouraging for all those folks that are maybe early career professionals getting into the privacy law space.
Right. And I think from the technological standpoint too, it points out that the court is really putting itself in the role of trying to understand on behalf of the public what's going on here. You know, you raise the issue, is this data on the phone? Is it at the cell site? Does that matter? My husband asked me when we were talking about the case, you mean there's no way to do anything to your cell phone so that you can't be tracked? You know, my understanding is that the answer to that is no. I mean, I suppose there are certain services and dark phones you can use that help enhance your privacy. But as long as you are within the cellular network connecting to a cellular tower, those towers are going to know where you are. They're going to register. You know, there were some 13,000, as you said, Emery, instances of where they were able to pinpoint this defendant's location over time. And that's simply a function of how the cellular network works. And many people, my husband included, just, you know, haven't put that together yet. So,
and I would think that many people, your husband included, would not consider himself as having consented to give that data over.
Right.
You know, it's not like he's saying, yeah, you can access it. It is, you're absolutely right. There's no real way to hide that information from your provider. Another interesting point that was brought up, I can't remember which justice brought it up, but they reiterated the point that was, I think, originally expressed in Riley, that, you know, smartphones are not really optional in today's world, that you have it's not even like you have the opportunity or the option to choose between participating in the modern society and giving up your privacy or protecting your privacy and not participating in the modern society, which is interesting and encouraging. Hey, Emery here. So one of my very favorite clips of the year comes from the last episode of the year where we talked about Uber and Waymo, where honestly just about everything went wrong. Whether we're talking about e-discovery or ephemeral messaging or destruction of evidence or industrial espionage, honestly, this case has it all, and I can't wait to see either the movie or the lesson plan that's going to be spawned from it.
This is the trade secrets case that has to do with secrets that were allegedly brought from Uber to Google by way of its Waymo arm. I have that right, right? It's secrets that went from Uber to Google and not the other way around. Mike, help me out here.
I think the claim is right. Uber, or a company that was acquired by Uber, had taken trade secrets of Waymo, which is the self-driving car division of Alphabet, Google.
Yes. Okay. Thank you. We are now headed down the self-driving road in the right direction. secrets alleged to have been appropriated by Uber when it hired Way.
I do want to point out, though, that... That confusion that you had, Denise, I had it as well. And I just would like, as someone like, especially Matt, you can speak to having, you know, in law school, you read a bunch of historical opinions and the language is very precise. And I think that may be a side effect of more casual speaking judges and attorneys and the language of the courtroom, because when it's reduced to a transcript, there's a lot of things like, you know, you said this to you, right? Or just confusion about like, wait, who's saying what and where and when is what's going on? So,
all right. So surprise, Uber is alleged to be the bad guy here. And it got worse last week. And the way in which it got worse is there are federal prosecutors actually looking at Uber's conduct here to see if federal criminal charges should be brought against Uber for its activity here. This is a civil case at the moment. And those federal prosecutors went to Judge Alsup, the judge in this case. Judge Alsup was also the judge in the Oracle versus Google case that we're going to talk about a little bit later, too. And these federal prosecutors said, hey, we've got a letter. We're going to give it to you. We're not going to make it public. The judge has not made it public. But it had some information about Uber basically hiding the ball, not disclosing things that it knew or should have known or should have disclosed in the litigation. And so a firestorm that had nothing to do with the actual wildfires in California ensued in court last week as Judge Alsup tried to make sense of all of this. One of the fallouts of this is the case was scheduled to go to trial at the end of December. That has now been postponed until February. And in the meantime, when you read through the transcripts of the days of court proceedings on this, you can see that Judge Alsup is just at his wit's end in dealing with these parties and particularly Uber. The lawyers for Uber find themselves in the situation of having to say, hey, we didn't know any of this was going on. If it did happen, you know, it wasn't our directions to our client, which is never a good position to be in as a lawyer when your client is accused of doing bad things. So the judge's patience is coming to an end, and the case is not coming to as rapid of an end because the judge went ahead and postponed things. Mike, you've probably been watching the procedural back and forth here more closely than I have. What would you add?
I have. I mean, this is like made for TV trial.
Yeah.
I mean, this is really something. I mean, I've never heard of a civil trial being postponed. I mean, the federal government, the Department of Justice swoops in, you know, provides a sealed document to the court, and the court, you know, decides to delay trial. I mean, they were set to go to trial, and literally this happened, I think, at the pretrial conference. And so now, as you mentioned, Denise, the trial is delayed until February. You know, there's so much drama here associated with this secret shadow system that Uber allegedly had. in place, and all of this encrypted messaging that went back and forth between Uber employees. So you've got that that piece of drama, which is pretty heady stuff. Then you've got the whole issue about this letter from Rick Jacobs' lawyer, who is the former Uber employee, that had written a rather scathing letter about these Uber practices. Uber never turned that over in discovery. And of course, Waymo was going crazy saying that this letter should have been turned over to us months ago. You've got interesting drama associated with the search terms that the parties exchanged during the course of discovery.
That was my favorite.
I mean, which is like, which is really
explain that in some detail, Mike, because I think people will just be blown away.
Yes. So how it works typically in any case of any size in federal court is the parties just don't turn over all their emails or electronic documents. Typically what happens is some sort of electronic discovery order is entered by the court, and the parties then agree to search their systems using search terms. And it can vary from case to case, but say in a typical case, or at least typical cases that I'm involved in, it could be anywhere between 10 to 20 different search terms. So we agree on search terms that we're all going to go back and search our client's systems for. Well, apparently, this letter that's at issue didn't come up in Uber's search because it didn't have any of the search terms in it. And it came out in court that one of the search terms that Waymo, I guess, neglected to have Waymo be a search term in the search terms that it gave to Uber, which I think a lot of people were scratching their head at. I mean, of course you would want to have the name of your company, Waymo, in the search terms that that you have the other side search their systems for.
Case about appropriating trade secrets from Waymo. Yeah. You didn't include the search term Waymo in the e-discovery process.
This may be a function, though. This may be a function, though, of Google just changing the names of their companies just way too much. That at the time, it was some other name of a company, and like they would have used up all their search terms looking at all the names of their companies.
Right. Wasn't there some sort of assertion that we couldn't have them search for Waymo because then we would have been drowned in documentation or
booleans, guys? Booleans, yes. Come on.
What would Google do with more information? Who knows?
Right, exactly. Like, Google bad at parsing information. Wow.
It's been
fascinating.
Yeah, you've got all of that. And then, Denise, as you had mentioned, Judge Alsup, very experienced, smart judge who's been involved in some major trials between tech titans. I mean, he's, I think, just exasperated by this, by everything. I mean, this is just going to be fascinating to see how it plays out. Yeah, there's some doozies for the judge in this case.
Right. So essentially, Waymo is pushing back against the idea that Uber can then ask Waymo about any kind of ephemeral messaging tools that they might use. And Judge Alsup, I'm going to quote from an Ars Technica article written by Cyrus Farivar earlier this week. And this is also the sort of confusion that I was talking about earlier. Judge Alsup wasn't having any of it. This is a direct order and the public ought to be aware, he said. I can't stand it when Waymo or the other side wants to have it both ways. You have the court's permission to ask not only the practice but the policies about ephemeral communications when they were at Waymo and then preserve those records where they obstructed your inquiry because they may be shown to the jury. Now, this is what I talk about confusing language that I wish people would avoid. A few moments – and just like help me parse this sentence, listeners. A few moments later, Judge Alsup was unequivocal addressing Perlson, quote, "You're trying to blame them for ephemeral and they get to show if you do it just as badly as you do it," he said.
Yes, which comes across fine in a courtroom and not so much in writing. Yes, indeed. Well, this whole ephemeral communication thing I think is one of the most fascinating parts of all this. Of course, we're talking about cutting edge – tech companies using cutting edge technology, taking the advice of people like us who get on the internet and say, hey, you know, use secure communications, or I guess secure is not the same as ephemeral, but still communications that may make it harder to see the content of what it is you are communicating. And they're taking that to heart and they're doing it. And now we're seeing, a judge say, hey, if you've got messages that are self-destructing, I think that looks really shady.
They're very selectively doing it. They were using these self-destructing messages when they were out tracking the Waymo cars.
Industrial espionage branch of Uber that apparently exists just to do, quote, market analysis. And it's just literally exfiltrating data apparently from other companies, but allegedly. Sorry, Matt.
Yeah, no. I mean, I think you said it with better emphasis than I would have. So it's not like Uber's using encrypted data that self-destructs in all of their communications. I think that's what the judge was upset about. And so,
aren't they, in addition to these ephemeral communications, isn't there the secret server where a bunch of things were stored? And that was kind of outside of the normal process that would typically be used for storing corporate data. Wasn't that also a big part the court was disturbed about?
I think that's what the court was upset about. It was like, so you let them search, because you had to, because that's part of the court process, is that they get to search your server. Well, if you have two servers and all of the relevant information is on one and you let them search the other, then you're not complying with the process of justice, which is discovery and, e-discovery and like all of this. So if you're building in dual systems to subvert it, it just looks really bad.
Yeah. The other thing that I think is really interesting about the judge's comments is, typically discovery disputes, every case has a discovery dispute. Some disputes are larger than others, this one being an example of that. But typically juries don't hear about discovery disputes. The jury gets to decide the facts that are relevant to the underlying dispute. But, all the back and forth and the discovery motions and all of that goes out the window when you go to trial. But here, it sounds like Judge Alsup is considering allowing some of this evidence to come in, particularly if there's evidence that the documents were destroyed. I mean, that can be very damning and can be heard by a jury or the fact finder in a case, depending on the circumstances. And it sounds like maybe Judge Alsup is considering letting some of that evidence come in, which could be very very hurtful.
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting case in so many ways, and of course, poor Judge Alsup having to parse all of this. It does seem like I wonder what will happen if these federal prosecutors decide they're going to press charges. What will happen to the civil proceedings at that point? Because certainly they seem concerned enough to communicate with the federal judge in the civil case, which is unusual in its own right. And I definitely think – go ahead.
The reason that the AUSA got wind of this was because Judge Elstrap informed them that they should look into this. So like the whole thing is very unusual. Yeah. Maybe Mike or you, Denise, know more, but I don't know of examples – where a judge is looking at a trade secrets case and says, attorney's office, like this is something you need to be aware of. So the whole thing looks bad.
I am so legitimately interested. I'm sure that if it's not out there already, that in the next few years, some very cool law professor is going to have a whole class about Uber. In fact, if that already exists out there, listeners, maybe let me know. We can talk about it on the show. But it's just that you can make a whole lesson plan for multiple semesters about just what's been going on with Uber in the past year.
But this is the future of self-driving. So what's amazing about all this is all this subterfuge and all of this intrigue is all based on the technology invented by this gentleman, Corey Lewandowski, which literally made the technology possible for both Anthony, I'm sorry, made the technology possible for both Uber and Google. So we're talking about the pinnacle of the height of technology innovation. So it's just really exciting and So, yeah, it's.
I would watch this movie, is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure.
After years of litigation and a huge Supreme Court victory, Simon Tam of the band The Slants joined Mike Keyes, Matt Curtis, and me to describe why he thought it was so important to be able to have a federal trademark registration in the name of the band, The Slants.
Well, a trademark registration is important for people engaged in the marketplace because it offers additional protections to their brands. There's certain benefits, in particular for artists. It's important because a lot of times major record label deals and sync licensing deals are hinged upon having a trademark registration. But that being said, for us, it's been a lot bigger than just a trademark registration. If it was only about that, I imagine we probably would have given up many, many years ago because mm-hmm. of how expensive and how long of a process it is. We chose to fight because we believed that it was really important for communities to decide what's best for themselves and not be subject to the arbitrary opinions of an examining attorney at the USPTO. And so we chose to fight because we were challenging the government. They had their full power, the full weight of the government, denying us our rights, and they were hinging all of that evidence on a joke website, urbandictionary.com. That was the only bit of evidence that they had that anyone could possibly find the name The Slants to be disparaging. And so it kicked off a long, kind of more philosophical and ethical battle than anything else of deciding, do we allow this office to make those decisions for our community? What happens when our community disagrees? Because no matter how much evidence we brought to the table saying, hey, we're not offensive to ourselves, it would never be good enough to meet their kind of arbitrary standards.
Right. And it seems like you have been frustrated all along waiting for the USPTO to tell you who in the Asian American community or the Asian community at large was actually offended by your band's name, that it was hard to find anybody who was going to raise their hand and say, yes, the naming a rock band, The Slants, offends me.
And that's correct. And they had many opportunities to. And even though we'd supplied them with independent national surveys, dictionary experts, multiple community organizations that stood up, they said that all of that wasn't good enough. That they mm-hmm. said, well, hey, we found this dictionary from 1937. It lists slant as possible offensive slang. We have urbandictionary.com, of course. And they included photos of Miley Cyrus pulling her eyes back in a slant eye gesture. And all that was supposed to be more valid than the actual community itself, which, of course, is paternalistic and offensive.
Right. So it was very important to you, it sounds like, personally and societally. It's also important, and your lawyers, I'm sure, were telling you this from a business standpoint, as you were pointing out, there are benefits to having a trademark registration that you were deprived of. And there is legal authority that the USPTO was relying on to deprive you of it. And that's why there was this back and forth with them about whether or not your mark actually violated this provision of the law that USPTO was relying on. And what happened last week was that provision or parts of it, and Mike, I want to get into that with you, were held to be unconstitutional by the US Supreme Court. So, Mike, why don't we kick it to you now to bring us up to speed on what exactly the PTO was relying on. Tell us about 15 U.S.C. Section 1052.
Sure. So 1052 is a portion of the Lanham Act, also known as Section 2 or more precisely Section 2A of the Lanham Act. And Section 2A of the Lanham Act has a number of provisions upon which an examiner is required to examine a trademark registration and see if it overcomes some of these hurdles that would allow the examiner to deny the registration. For example, In Section 2A, there is a provision that used to prohibit registration of a of an offensive or disparaging name. That was precisely the issue or the provision that was at issue in Simon's case. There's other provisions in Section 2A that deal with immoralist or scandalous marks. Those are not subject to registration. We can talk about in a moment whether that provision still survives in light of the court's decision. Still other portions of Section 2 prohibit registration of marks that contain a U.S. flag. And also, I think the signature and/or image of a president, something akin to that. So there's a number of prohibitions at issue in Section 2A, but the one specifically that was at issue is in Simon's case is the one that prohibits disparaging registrations. That provision, and Simon can probably articulate this better than just about any trademark lawyer out there. But that provision had been interpreted by the courts and the PTO that if the mark at issue would be disparaging to a substantial composite of the referenced community, then that would be sufficient for the PTO examiner to reject the application. And so everything that Simon was just mentioning a moment ago about how they gathered a lot of evidence during the process to show that this would not be offensive or disparaging to a substantial composite of the Asian American community. That was really important evidence during the legal battle. So that kind of provides the framework for what was at issue.
Right. And we've been following this case because it's been rattling around in the courts. Simon filed their trademark application, had it declined, and then appealed that to the Federal Circuit. And the Federal Circuit found essentially what the Supreme Court found last week, that the PTO should not be making decisions like this on the grounds that it was making them, that the PTO was wading into muddy, muddy waters that impinged on our First Amendment rights of free speech. So we can talk about that a little bit more in a moment. But first, I want to get into this idea of what's disparaging and what's not, and why this was so problematic to have the PTO attempting to struggle with decisions like this and coming back to Simon with an explanation drawn from the Urban Dictionary and photos of Miley Cyrus. Simon has an op-ed in the New York Times, a Supreme Court decision, Simon, and an op-ed in the New York Times all in the same week. That's a big week right there. And it leads off with an anecdote that is really, really powerful that explains why you named the band what you did, or how you weren't thinking about this when you were 11. You weren't thinking about what you were going to name the band, but this experience that you had when you were 11 influenced you. Can you tell us, our listeners, about that experience, please?
Sure. This happened actually when I was in junior high school, and I was responsible for cleaning up kind of the sports equipment left over from recess. And so I just kind of stayed back to pick up basketballs, volleyballs, and that sort of thing. I remember having a lot of trouble fitting in at the elementary school and middle school as well, because kids would pick on me for my ethnicity. It didn't really kind of went beyond, you know, people making fun of me until it got kind of violent. And that was the experience that I wrote about. I was hanging back, putting things away, and I didn't notice, but another group of students actually stayed back as well. They kind of hid. I didn't find out till I was pushed to the ground and then found, you know, sand and dirt being kicked into my eyes, people kicking me in the stomach, all while yelling Jap and Gook over and over again. And I didn't really know what to do until at one point I just finally snapped and I said, I'm a chink. Like, if you're going to be racist, at least do it correctly. Like, that's how stupid you are. You don't even know how to be a racist properly. And they immediately stopped. They left me alone. And I realized there was just a lot of power in claiming an identity, in claiming words and saying that you can't use those against me. Those belong to me and my community. And it was something that just stopped people in their tracks. They just were really shocked. And I kind of had similar experiences throughout my life. But the slants is kind of one of those things that, you know, when I was trying to think of band names, I asked people around me, you know, what's something you think all Asians have in common? And they would almost always say slanted eyes, which I think is really interesting because, first of all, it's not true. Not all Asians have slanted eyes, and Asian people are not the only people on earth with any kind of slant to their eyes. But more importantly, I thought, what a great way to pay homage to the work of Asian American activists who've been using slant in this kind of self-empowering way for decades now. We could really honor their work while talking about our perspective or our slant on life, if you will, of what it's like to navigate the entertainment industry as people of color. And so it became kind of this badge of pride, like the very, very same thing that was used against me to cause me shame and embarrassment, and the very thing that caused all that bullying, now all of a sudden was something that I could say, you know what? I shouldn't be ashamed of this, and that other people shouldn't be ashamed of it as well.
Yeah, that story so tore me apart when I read it. Number one, that you had to go through it. Number two, that it happened in San Diego, California, just down the road basically from where I live. And I think of Southern California as a really culturally diverse and accepting place. And the fact that it happened to you when you were 11, which was not that long ago. you were born in 1981, I believe. So says Wikipedia. So to me, that feels like just how can, you know, the fact that that could happen, where it happened and when it happened really rocked me. And really, I think is powerful in telling the story of why you wanted to name the band what you did, both from a a business practicality standpoint and from a personal and social health standpoint. From a business practicality standpoint, Mike, that registering a trademark is not something that is divorced from what we do here on the show at all. It's really critical in how people have an online identity as well. It's really critical. For example, the band has the trademark. Well, now they've had the domain, theslants.com. And now that they will be able to have the trademark, that gives that domain much more sticking power, doesn't it?
That's right. I mean, when you have a trademark registration, as Simon was alluding to, you have certain benefits, not only in the marketplace vis-a-vis third parties, but in the eyes of the law, you actually have enhanced benefits that you can take advantage of as a result of having that registration. For example, in any court proceeding where you would go to enforce your trademark rights, if you have a federal registration issued by the government, you can walk into court and that mark is presumed to be valid, meaning that you have preemptive nationwide rights with respect to that trademark registration because the federal government has given it to you. And that's a pretty powerful piece of evidence that one can have when you go into court. You don't have to establish that the mark is valid. So in terms of enforcing trademarks, that's always a real benefit to have. Another benefit that you get with registration is you get certain enforcement benefits. For example, you could take your registration if you were concerned about infringing goods coming in from overseas or elsewhere. You know, you can take that registration and take it to customs, and they can assist you with enforcement efforts. So that's another benefit that the statute provides. I can also tell you from my own personal experience in helping clients that have infringing activities that are taking place online, a lot of big companies that are in the business of providing content and otherwise, they will take a demand much more seriously if you can show that it's being sent on behalf of a client who has a trademark registration or a family of registrations, it's just considered more powerful and more persuasive. So there, this isn't a theoretical or hypothetical type of, mm-hmm. of situation that Simon was dealing with here. This is really real, real life consequences that are pretty significant when it comes to a federal registration. Not to mention all the business reasons that Simon just mentioned, it's important for label purposes and others. If you have a registration, it shows it gives you certainly an air of legitimacy versus others.
Bebe Chui joined Mike Keyes, Matt Curtis, and me to describe the Atrium Law Firm and give us a tour. She also turned the camera around on Justin TV's and Twitch's Justin Kahn. You were showing us before we started recording where your office and how it looks. It doesn't look like any law firm I've been in before. Can you give us the virtual
tour?
Yeah,
we'll give you. For sure. Okay, so I'm in one of the conference rooms. I'm going to show you guys. Sorry about the shakiness. We just moved in here. So there's like whiteboards everywhere, right? And then this is an office where we are all sitting together. Like all the lawyers are sitting in pods. So this is where, guys, don't be on Facebook. No, I'm kidding. Okay, so, you're live. Okay. So anyway, so we sit in pods. This is like what we call the Atrium Council sign. So this is our, all of the attorneys here are from Fenwick or from like Gunderson, and we are the startup's first general counsel. So that's that. And then this is the intake department where we also have a lot of virtual paralegals, but there's paralegals working on just like collecting documents and organizing them on a full-time basis. And then this is our deals team who does all the wonderful deals that to help our clients raise money and whatnot. So, and it's like pretty much panoramic office. We have the entire floor. Outside there's you can't see the smoke, but.
Yeah.
So, which is.
There we go.
But there is a lot of smoke, but this is exactly Soma, which is the heart of where all the startups are in San Francisco. And most interestingly, even though we encounter this space, right? Like we discovered that it overlooks, do you see where it says Sixth Sense here?
Yeah.
So that was Justin TV old, first office where it started.
Oh, that's
and,
great.
I wish we can zoom in, but it looks like a mess. And we were just constantly reminding ourselves, this is where, Justin started, and look at him now. And, we should work hard.
That's right. Your colleagues should be used to you wandering around with a camera while they're working, because if Justin were there, that's sort of an occupational hazard.
I'm on brand right now. Okay, let's go find Justin. Actually, this is going to be really fun. this is so meta. Justin. Justin. Hi, we're on a live podcast where there's a lot of audience. But this is Justin. And how does it feel to be on the recipient of, someone else holding the camera?
Hi, Justin. I was telling Bebe years ago, I met you at On Hollywood, and I was an early person you put on Justin TV. So
yeah,
we're turning the camera back on you.
Yeah, we're turning the camera back. It's so funny. So hilarious. Anyway, so yeah, exciting stuff. We hope to, fill this office up very soon with every venture lawyer in the city. We counted about a couple hundred, and this space fits that. So.
Awesome. As you know, on This Week in Law, we conclude with a tip of the week and a resource of the week and one of our favorites, the animal selfie of the week. One of our resources of the week earlier in the year might help you out if you have some international travel scheduled over the holidays. It might help you do the math on whether or not to unlock your device for a U.S. border agent. With a new version of the travel ban making its way out of the White House, we're told, by next week, I'm seeing a number of articles pop up grappling with the notion of advising you what you need to, under the law,
give over to Customs and Border Protection officers should they ask you coming into the country. And again, these are something you should read in more detail. The short answer is that they have far more latitude to search you in that kind of situation than they would if you were firmly on U.S. soil, having been admitted to the country. And the other short answer is there are some legal gray areas here that scholars point out and are, you know, it's hard to say, you know, for sure the extent of the Border Patrol's authority, but things that you might be asked to do, like turn over, you know, unlock your device and let someone look at what you've already logged into, is something you might have to grapple with, and possibly actually log into something that they wouldn't have access to simply by unlocking your device, is something you might have to grapple with. And really, what these articles and the people quoted in them come down to is, yes, you might have some legal basis for an objection to the search, but it depends how much you really want to inconvenience yourself by taking that legal stand. And that's something that every traveler who's in this situation would have to decide. But our couple of resources here, one comes from Ars Technica. Cyrus Farivar there wrote up a piece called What Could Happen If You Refuse to Unlock Your Phone at the U.S. Border. And then similarly in the New York Times, Daniel Victor has an article called What Are Your Rights If Border Agents Want to Search Your Phone? So if you're curious on those points and want to help yourself or someone else sort of do that math as to when you should put your foot down or not and what you're willing to tolerate in the way of delay and detention or not, those pieces will help you get there. One of our favorite cases in 2017 is one that Mike Keyes has been following closely over on his firm's blog, the TMCA. It's been going on since last year's holiday season. One of his updates on the case was all in verse, and it involves the publication of a work that is a Dr. Seuss Star Trek mashup called Oh, the Places You'll Boldly Go.
This is a post that I wrote about the case involving Dr. Seuss, a company called Comic Mix. We've talked about it before on the show. Comic Mix came up with a book called Oh, the Places You'll Boldly Go, which is a mashup of Star Trek and Dr. Seuss, and Dr. Seuss sued. And we have a ruling from the court on Comic Mix's motion to dismiss. So this is a blog post entitled Fair Use on the Loose for the Great Dr. Seuss. And it reads, you may remember, you may recall, a certain infringement suit filed last fall. It was filed by the heirs of the great Dr. Seuss. And now they've run smack dab into the doctrine of fair use. Let me tell you what happened. It's a tale worth telling. For the defendant is cheering and the plaintiff is yelling. How did the suit start? Why was the doc in a fix? It all started with the company called Comic Mix. They do mishups and mashups, wreaking havoc and heck. And their latest creation mixed Dr. Seuss with Star Trek. They gave it a title. It's surely one that you know. They called it, Oh, the Places You'll Boldly Go. The plaintiff did not like it, not one little bit. And they fussed and they fumed and were in quite a twit. So they filed a lawsuit with a big ferocious bark. Stop copying our work and infringing our mark. Copy, you say, defendant said with a hiss. We're going to file a motion to dismiss. And file they did under Rule 12b-6. Filed their motion, did Comic Mix. Perhaps to their surprise and their utter delight, the court said, hey, Comic Mix, you're largely right. The court said it was fair for the use of the mark. Those claims were gone, tossed into the dark. But the copyright claims, oh, those will stay for a while. Plaintiff holds on, and we'll take those to trial. The court plowed through fair use, plowed through like a tractor, and it all came down to that last fair use factor. The court said it wasn't clear if the market value was hurt. That's a question for the jury. It will be on alert. So the saga continues. There may be no truce, for fair use is on the loose for the great Dr. Seuss.
Yay! Hey.
Thank you.
I'm bowing. Well done. Right now.
So that's it for our best of episode of 2017. We thank you so much for joining us. We hope you have a wonderful rest of the holiday season. We'll see you soon in January 2018. Until then, take care.